It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Today you're going to hear from our latest Key 3 chef, John Besh. He's going to explain how to fry an egg. Now, a chef with stars around his name just frying an egg? Well, yeah, because this ubiquitous little oval is a test of skill. You know those tall chef hats with pleats? Well, there's supposed to be 101 of them, one for each way that you can cook an egg. A dozen eggs in the fridge, and you have entertainment for days, as in slow bake them in cream with some nutmeg and cheese. Dinner was never this good. Stay with us. There's a lot more this hour on The Splendid Table. The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Japanese restaurants were pretty much unknown in the United States until well after World War II. Sushi, for instance, didn't make its appearance stateside until the mid-1950s. But these days you can find Japanese cuisine in just about every city in the United States. Now, one of the key people who's helped Japanese cuisine flourish in the country is Daisuke Otagawa. Born in Tokyo, he began his apprenticeship in sushi when he was 16 years old. Well, now he co-owns Sushi Co., the oldest sushi restaurant in Washington, D.C. Reporter Rebecca Shear recently sat down with Otagawa to talk about his life in food and about Japanese food in America, past, present, and the future.
Daisuke, thanks for joining us. So tell me, how did Japanese food spread in America?
I always sort of think Japanese cuisine spread in America in stages. First, there was this, you know, tempura, sukiyaki, that was, I think, brought by the military people after the World War II. And then in the late 70s, early 80s, sushi started. And at the same time, I think back then the government came up with sort of a recommendation of how Americans should eat to be healthy. And I think they said something like along the lines of, if you eat like Japanese, you'll be fine. And that, I think, helped. And now there are all these different kind of Japanese restaurants opening, ramen restaurants, soba restaurants. There are even tonkatsu, which is a breaded cutlet, Japanese-style restaurants, and izakaya, which is sort of a Japanese pub. And Japan has always culturally taken in outside influence and Japanified it. Sushi really originally was from China several thousand years ago. So, you know, Japanese cuisine is very, very wide in variety.
And you know a thing or two about variety, given all the projects that you already have going and the ones that are soon to come. Let's start with the Japanese cocktail bar. What exactly is a Japanese cocktail bar, and how would you say it differs from the typical cocktail bar you'd find here in the States?
Japanese bars has sometimes a function of almost a neighborhood social club. It's not uncommon to go to Japanese, what we call shot bar. You know, many bars usually serve what's called bottle keep. You buy the whole bottle and they keep it for you for a certain amount of time, and you go back there because, you know, you tell your friend, hey, I have a bottle kept at such and such,
throughout your visits, multiple visits, the bottle is still waiting
exactly,
for you.
Exactly, right. Wow. So to counter that, people started opening what's called shot bar. That's actually the closest thing to, I think, American bar, where they serve cocktails and they charge by a glass or shot. But, you know, some shot bar you go to, it's not uncommon to hear a customer talking to the bartender saying, you know what, I just read such and such poem and I feel this way. I want to compliment my feeling. Can you make me a cocktail? I mean, you know, if I would hear that, I would normally start laughing, but it's normal. And the bartender will take that really serious and would actually love that sort of interaction. And he will make a cocktail to make the mood. So in that sense, it's a little bit different from here. There are also bars that has a particular theme. I mean, there are jazz bars. You're not really allowed to talk in there because they will have unbelievable jazz collection, things that you probably won't be able to find even in the United States, old records. And they'll be playing this, but you go there and, you know, they might only have three kinds of whiskey because that's what the proprietor think would go well with listening to jazz. and you know, and that's the experience that you get from that.
Well, going back now to Japanese food, mm-hmm. You were talking about how in Japan you take in so many cultures from the outside and you sort of Japanify mm-hmm. it. How do you then translate the Japanese food to the American palate?
We don't. We try to bring what is essential in what I think the Japanese cuisine is. I cannot really speak for other people, but normally we don't try to, you know, change the recipe to meet American palate or you know, non-Japanese palate. Having said that, I think it's not taking an advantage of being in America if you only rigidly stick to the practices in Japan. Whenever two cultures meet, naturally slight changes occur, and I think that itself is a beautiful thing. And let me talk in terms of sushi bar. Mm-hmm. And sushi bar is one of the rare occasions one can sit in front of the cooks who's going to make your food. And because of that, each time when we serve something, we can see the customer's reaction. So if somebody said, this is the first time I'm going to have sushi, I don't think the sushi chef will be serving sea urchin. I was told by my teacher in Japan, he said, listen, when the customer sits in front of you, it is your job to take them on a journey. And I would say, why? And he said, well, because you can. And, you know, for the longest time, I didn't understand it. Same thing about subtlety and ingredients. He would say something like, if you want to be a really good cook, you have to really understand the ingredients and listen to it. If you listen to it long enough, it will tell you what to do. Okay. You know, it took a very long time to understand it. But, you know, that's sort of the philosophy that they have. So, I mean, to give you a very simple example, Sunday, you know, late afternoon, restaurant just opened. There's two men who sits in front of you. They're friends. One came from working all day because he had some project that he had to finish. The other one went golfing, typical Japanese. Now, you can tell by the way they are, and they might have talked about it. You might ask them, hey, how was your day, whatever. So what you do, you start them off with the two little different appetizers, or otsukidashi is what we call it. It's like these little freebies that you start them to whet their appetite, right? The guy who worked in the office, you might give them something with a little bit of vinegar. Vinegar stimulates your salivary glands, and, you know, they might wake up and they might think, oh, God, I'm ready to eat. And the guy who went golfing, he probably was sweating all day, so you give him something salty. And you might start them off from two separate places, but you might, you know, try to join them at some point, and then you take them on a journey. And, you know, I'm trying to come back to the question of how do we, you know, bring it to American palate. We don't. What we do is try to instill the philosophy of Japanese cuisine into the ingredients that's available here, into the techniques that we may not have known, incorporate them all, but still make it a Japanese food in its core.
Well, Daisuke Utagawa, it has been a pleasure talking with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Daisuke Utagawa owns Sushi Co. in Washington, D.C. Rebecca Shear is a host, reporter, and producer at WAMU. Now you can find more information on our website, splendidtable.org. Intrepid is how you could think about the Stearns, Jane and Michael. These two go anywhere to eat anything if there's a possibility of a find. And they tell us about the princes they've kissed, as opposed to the frogs. Jane? Michael, welcome back, guys.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
So where have you guys been?
Mecca.
I beg your pardon?
On our annual pilgrimage.
I wish we could go at least once annually.
The Mecca we're talking about is not the the Mecca that you're thinking of. It's a eatery in Dallas, Texas that is one of the great old hash houses.
The motto, I should say, of the Mecca in Dallas is Waking Up Dallas Since 1938.
A lot of heritage there.
It is. And, you know, it's the food is great.
Great in every sense of the word, meaning not only good, but huge.
Copious
amounts. Huge. I just have to say the sweet roll there is... it's like the size of a plate. And it's not the best cinnamon roll on earth, but it's the most cinnamon roll on earth.
Yeah. I mean, this place, I love it. Let's say food would be second and ambiance would be first.
No, first be even before ambiance is the waitresses. I mean, these waitresses. It's a show. I remember we got there very early one morning. And I remember one waitress came in a little bit late. And she said, happy Saturday. Let's rock. Let's drive everybody crazy. And the other waitresses called back to her. One waitress said, I'm still defrosting this morning, hon, so it'll take a while.
Most people do eat there with friends. A lot of workmen go there sort of in groups at the beginning of the day. And if one person comes in solo, you will always be asked, you waiting on a joiner, honey, or sweetheart? So, you know, it's kind of just a wonderful time capsule where you can sort of go back to the 1930s and 40s and hear this hash house lingo while you're eating a pretty decent enormous plate of biscuits with sausage gravy.
And it does have a kind of Tex-Mex accent to the menu as well. I mean, one of the really good things to eat there is what's known as migas, which is the scrambled eggs with little bits of tortilla in it. And the option you can get with your migas, in addition to the tortilla folded into the scrambled eggs, is crumbled chorizo sausage, which adds a whole nother spice level. And their refried beans are so good. I mean, these are classic refritos, you know, which just laced with lard, so that lard just kind of melts into the beans at every forkful.
And they also have the Southern classic. And, you know, Dallas is sort of an interesting blend between the West and the South of grilled pimento cheese sandwiches. And usually pimento cheese sandwiches in the South are fairly dainty. This is like
this is a
gigantic
big one.
Wad of pimento cheese. The great thing is you can get anything anytime.
But the waitresses sound like they're worth the trip. So
yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Old school.
Yep. Thanks, you too.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern report on their sleeves up dining finds on their site, roadfood.com, and here. So check out their latest at splendidtable.org. Well, we're going to be back with the duo behind the perennial plate, a hands-on grassroots trek around the planet. And Chef John Besh and another installment of Key 3. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Chef John Besh is a poster boy for Southern charm. He's our latest Key 3 chef. Now, with Key 3, we go into the kitchens of exceptional cooks to learn firsthand the three dishes that they think every cook and wannabe cook should know. Well, for John's Key 3, we went to New Orleans to his restaurant, August. August is in an old French-style building downtown. It's a restaurant that you dress up for. But the kitchen is where we had all the fun. That's where John announces you as you enter so that all the cooks can yell out a welcome. So here was John, ready for his Key 3, with a skillet, eggs, and some other interesting things. John, it's great to be here in the kitchen with you. So what are your Key 3?
One is a creamy vegetable soup, a creamy any vegetable soup. And just to know the basics of how to do this without using a lot of cream and just using what the vegetables give us naturally is something inherent that I think every cook needs to know. Another is to make a good risotto. Risotto is so misunderstood, and I think to make a good risotto takes a little bit of restraint and takes some respect from the cook. And I just love to do that, and I think every great chef needs to know. The last but not least is something as simple as cooking an egg. When you take a beautiful farm egg that's been raised on this great diet and you do as little to it as possible and you cook it just ever so gently, sunny side up, or as the French would say, au plat plat, would just be perhaps the tastiest thing you've ever had in your life. And I can't wait to share
it with you. I've never heard a fried egg being described with quite that. All right, so where do you want to begin? Which one do you want to do?
Let's do the fried egg.
Okay, all right, okay. So we've got, oh boy, these eggs are gorgeous. What? These eggs are multicolored. Are they, they're from
right,
a local
so,
farm?
Well, we, these all come from our farm across the lake. We actually have a chicken coop that stays in relatively high production. And so we have these incredible eggs. And we also have some of our farmstead butter from across the lake as well.
Oh, wow.
And you marry those two together. And let me tell you, it's just going to be perfect. Can I show you?
Sure. Go
Can
right
I really
ahead.
Get messy? Can I do this the way I would do it at home?
Go.
So what I'm doing is I'm taking just a little chilled farmstead butter and I'm rubbing it in a relatively liberal manner around this small cast iron pan.
And the pan is probably 8-9 inches in diameter.
Yeah,
and
I want something small. I don't want these eggs to really spread out too much. And I'd really, it's hard to have anything cool or room temperature in this hot kitchen.
Right.
It's relatively hot, but I'd like this to be a cool pan if possible. And so you have this cool smear of butter all over the small cast iron pan. And then we'll crack an egg. This egg comes from one of our Araconda chickens, which is
a breed out of
South America. And we're just going to drop those just like that. And maybe
putting the butter in a cool pan and you're cracking the eggs
right
into the cool pan. I've never seen this before.
Now, we have an egg from two different chickens. So
the yolks are really different, cute. Too. Bright orange and bright yellow.
And what I want to do is then place it over a low heat. I want this heat not to necessarily be low, 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 but I really want it to be something, if you were using a burner at your house, this would be medium low to medium flame. The beauty of this is that it's all about the egg, and it's all about just a little smear of butter. We want this to, you want the egg to coagulate really slow, right? And so right now we're watching the egg whites, and they're slowly turning to this opaque color. And I don't want is what my grandmother used to have happen in her cast iron skillet, and that sizzle and pop. And I don't want the eggs to start to caramelize. When you have the caramelization taking place, then you're adding flavors that distract us from the creaminess of the white and the yolk itself.
Do the eggs toughen when they cook that way?
I think they do. And watch this. It starts to bubble ever so slightly, and that's really not what I'm talking about.
The whites are getting solid. They're turning opaque.
And so you have the opaque whites. I'm just going to move this to as low a heat as possible. And I'm going to take a little bit of sea salt and just give a small dash of sea salt with my fingertips right over those eggs. These are cooking slow. And by doing this, I want those egg whites to coagulate at the same time that it takes the egg yolk just to heat all the way through. And you have perfection. God's given us these incredible eggs that we want to do as little to. We want to manipulate them as little as possible, bringing out the perfect flavor. And I think that's the beauty of something like an egg. You don't have to do much to it. And so once those egg whites have cooked all the way through, we're ready, and I'll just like place the back of my finger right over the egg yolks, and you'll notice they're still a little cold.
The egg yolk is still a little cool, but is it
and
cooked
I'm just gonna,
through?
It's not cooked through yet.
Okay.
And so I'm just going to remove it from the heat. Uh-huh. This is still a very hot pan, and within a minute, this will be nice and And we'll have these nice creamy whites that have cooked all the way through and the yolks are warm. That is heaven, sister.
John, this is really intriguing. I don't think I've seen slow-cooked eggs, but never this technique with a fried egg. So this is the slower the better?
Right. I think the slower the better, the highest quality egg and butter, the better. Uh-huh. And so small amount of butter. And just take this cold pan. It goes against the grain of everything that we're taught as cooks.
Right.
The cook, or I say the chef in us all, our inner chef, wants to overdo everything it is that we cook. We want to over-season. We want to mask. We want to manipulate. But if we can restrain ourselves from doing that, we will allow this egg to become almost magical. And now, feel that egg yolk right there.
All right.
The back of your finger ever so
it's
slightly. See how it's just starting to warm up.
Warming up. Just warming up.
And so that tells us that it is done. Now, I'll just ease these out.
And we could do this in a Teflon pan if we wanted to, right?
You could, but you don't need to. And I think that's also part of the skill of cooking an egg properly, is where you're not relying on all these artificial contraptions. We actually have
that's beautiful.
Good old cast iron pot, or pan, rather, I'm sorry.
Okay, so now let's have a taste.
Which one are you going to give a shot to first?
Well,
you can see the difference in just the breed of chicken will give you a different
yolk. I think
I'm
going to try the...
They're both fed the same diet.
Right, but this is going to be the chicken with the green shell.
And so...
Ooh. Oh. This is like eating cream.
Isn't that good?
It's so soft and lush on the tongue and pure, unadulterated egg. Let me see if I can taste a difference from one egg to another. Oh, the other one, the yolk is richer tasting. It may be a case of it's cooked a little bit differently, or the salt, but it's a little richer tasting.
I think
tasting.
It might even be cooked just a little more. It was a slightly smaller egg.
Yes.
And so
yeah.
If you notice, that yolk actually warmed through. And the warmer it gets, the creamier of a texture that it's going to have. It's going to have a whole different mouthfeel. Two different chickens fed same diet, two different colored eggs, two different size eggs, cooked exactly the same. Low heat, a little bit of butter, and just a small amount of sea salt. That's heaven.
John, this is great. Thanks so much for having us.
Chef John Besh's latest book is My Family Table, and you can hear him talking about his other key three dishes and get his recipes for how to make a risotto of almost anything and cream of anything soup. This man is a working theme here. It's all at splendidtable.org. What a dream. Two people curious about food, the chef with serious restaurant chops, the writer and designer who knows how to handle a camera, and an agenda taking them around the world. 12 countries in 18 months. Well, this is The Perennial Plate. Its creator, Chef Daniel Klein, and videographer Mira Fine are here in the studio. Mira, Daniel, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
So you're just back from the first leg of the trip, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you were in China and Japan. So what stands out in your mind right now, for instance, about China?
We found this woman named Miss Yang. She's 32 years old. She lives in Kunming, which is in the Yunnan province. And she grew up in a village and then left to go to school and to be in the business world, and decided after being in the business world for a while and learning more about food that she wanted to create a restaurant that was focused only on local food that was organic. So she created this restaurant in Kunming and then gets most of her produce and her meats actually from her family in the village 2 hours away.
She found in the business world that she was quite unhappy and unfulfilled and was living her life in this sort of dream that her parents and many Chinese parents apparently have for their children, which is that they get away from the farm.
Right.
And she actually found that she didn't like that life that they had hoped for her, and she wanted to come back and even maybe farm. And it was sort of shameful if she would move back. And
her, so her parents were ashamed.
Her neighbors would be like, why would your daughter come back to the countryside to farm? And so struggling with that, she decided that opening a restaurant and supporting her parents through buying their produce would be a good way for her to reconnect with her roots without sort of bringing shame or bringing this sort of backwardsness to her family. And when we asked them what they thought of their daughter opening this restaurant, supporting the community, they weren't very talkative, but they said if they could say one word, they would say support.
Uh-huh.
So they supported their daughter in what she was doing and also shared that they had been making a lot more money since working with the daughter to sell the produce.
Right.
And the other really interesting thing about the story, I think, is that the restaurant in Kunming is this beautiful restaurant in this like beautiful space that she's decorated really, really elegantly. And then we went in this van with her and drove 2 hours to her village. And it's just this huge dichotomy in this very poor, small village. You know, it's just a very different environment.
And we made tofu together, which as a chef was fascinating. I had never made tofu before directly from the beans. So we ground them, made the soy milk, cooked it in each home in China in the countryside has a fire with a huge wok over the fire. And it's where they do all their cooking and cleaning and everything out of that one thing. So we were served lunch, fried, you know, pork belly and all these different things. And then they cleaned it out and cooked the soy milk in the wok. And it was so much better than any tofu I'd ever had.
And it was cool. I don't know if you've seen this before, where they, we saw them all over China. They take the head of a huge sunflower, and it's sun-dried, and they just put it on the table, and you pick out the sunflower seeds. So we sat there, like, sitting on the floor with this huge sunflower head, eating the sunflower seeds and drinking the warm soy milk while we were waiting for the rest of the soy to coagulate
to
into tofu.
I've never seen that. Well, what did you find in Japan?
In Japan, I mean, Japan is a culinary wonderland. so it was fascinating for me to eat there. And we had a wonderful experience at a gentleman who grows his own wheat and buckwheat to produce udon and soba noodles at a small town outside of Tokyo. And he was really about preserving the culture of this area that he grew up in. It's a farming area, and he didn't want to lose that. There's these beautiful community gardens, beautiful farms, and you can see the city sort of starting to develop in this area. Uh-huh. There's a big mall that's been built up near his home. So he wanted to preserve that, but just by growing wheat, he couldn't make enough money. And so he had been learning about udon and soba since he was a child because his parents made it. And he found that by opening a restaurant and sharing these traditional ways, he would be able to sell, you know, by adding value. He was able to preserve this farmland that he had had, that his family had had for all these years.
And I understand the making of those noodles is considered high craft.
It is. Mira has a sort of a funny story about making them.
Okay, so I was filming, and Mr. Shimizu-san, who was the man that we were filming, he came over to me and said, okay, I'm about to make the noodles. Do you want to see me make the dough? And so I said, okay. And so he was making this dough, which is just wheat, water, and salt. And then he put it on the floor in a bowl, put a plastic bag over it, and stepped in the bowl and started marching in a circle.
Oh, my.
And I didn't realize that happened. I later found out that that is a very traditional way, because using your feet helps create, like, an elasticity.
Makes so much sense when you think about it. You know, that you can achieve with your feet and the weight of your body a kind of kneading that you can't achieve if you're just using your hands.
Exactly. And he had Mira actually do it as well.
Yeah, it's hard to keep your balance.
So what did the noodles taste like?
Well, it was summertime. So in summertime, you serve the noodles cold. And in wintertime, you serve them hot.
Right.
And so what you're going for is they swell in the water when you cook them. So you want sort of this soft texture on the outside and then a bite in the middle. Sort of equivalent to al dente, but they're much more like chewy. They have more of a bounce back to them.
Yeah.
And you dip them usually in a dashi, in a broth made with katsuobushi or soy sauce, and served with various local vegetables.
Now, Mira, you're a vegetarian, so how did this trip work for you?
Going into the trip, when I would tell people about it, they would say, oh, Japan will be great. Good luck in China. And it was actually just the opposite. Japan, everything is made with dashi, with fish or with meat in some way. Dashi is the Japanese broth. But I was able to find certain things that I did like, which I later found out were made with dashi as well. But like, is it sekomono, I think? It's the pickled things.
Oh, yes. All the pickled vegetables.
Yeah. Which they have at the beginning of every meal in Japan. And they usually have the daikon radish, which is pickled. But one time they had this hot, hot pink shiso pickled garlic, which I just fell in love with. It was amazing. And as for China, I was so surprised because yin and yang is a very important philosophy in China, especially when it comes to food. So yin foods are foods that tend to bring the body temperature down. That's what they say. And they're usually vegetables. And yang foods are foods that bring the body heat up, which are meats. Except they did say that yin includes donkey. And yang also includes garlic.
I knew that. I knew that.
Donkey is delicious, by the way.
We Interesting.
We had donkey sandwiches and donkey dumplings.
By we, he means he did.
Yes.
You too. You've been delightful. Thanks for coming. Can't wait to hear the next reports.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Daniel Klein is founder of The Perennial Plate. Mira Fine is the videographer. Check out their videos on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back to take your questions in a minute, so stick around. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It is time to turn to your calls. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, splendidtable.org. Okay, we've got Nan calling from Encinitas, California. Nan, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, good morning, Lynn. How are you doing?
I am doing just swell. How about you?
Good, good. I had a wonderful opportunity recently to buy roasted Hatch chilies. One of my local markets bought them in by the case and had what they called a roasting event in the parking lot. You can imagine, I parked my car, opened the door, and went, what is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, when you go down to New Mexico, you drive along the roads and you can smell those babies roasting. It's just amazing. But go on with your question.
So that was exactly my experience. And, of course, I was drawn, like, you know, is there some cartoon character that follows the aroma through the air? I was drawn to the roasting table, and they had little samples so you could taste mild, medium, and they had medium hot. They weren't doing hot that day.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, I bought a container of the medium hot, which was the hottest I could get.
Right.
And I brought them home, and I said to my husband, look what I got. And he said, great, what are we going to do with them? And I went, right? There's more than I can use right now, so how do I keep them?
Okay, first of all, you can freeze them. That's number
one. Okay.
Now, have they been cleaned in the sense of has the black flaky, you know, skin?
Most of it, yeah.
Most of it. You want to get rid of most of that. But what you do, it's really simple, and I would do it. Now, how big are they?
They're chopped up in little pieces.
Oh, they're chopped up in little pieces. Okay. All right. You want to put them in a heavy-duty plastic bag, you know, and get all the air out, give it a name, give it a date. Put it in the freezer. And I do it in relatively small batches. And then, now, okay, first of all, you can make true chile, you know, the stew. And true chile, since you're talking Hatch, chilies are from New Mexico. And New Mexico chili never has beans in it and never has tomatoes in it. You do either one of those things and people sort of ask you to leave town, you know, that kind of thing. But one of the things you can do is this. You brown up some onion. And if you want to be really authentic, you might use a little lard or salt pork, but certainly you can do it in oil. And I'm Italian, so I do olive oil. Anyway, brown up some onion, throw in some garlic, brown up some beef,
And I do the beef really first, and I space it out. So you want chunks of beef about an inch square, inch and a half, right? And you brown that up in a bit of oil, salt, pepper, etc. And then what you do is pull those out of the pan, you do the onion, you throw in a bit of the garlic, and now there's two ways you can go. One way is you can just add those chilies with broth or water, and you can just put that beef back in there and you just let it cook. Usually a bit of oregano goes in there, and that's about it, because what you want is the true flavor of the chili and the meat. The other way you can go is take those chilies and puree them with garlic, a bit of water, and some oregano, and cook that down a bit so you blossom the flavor, and then throw that in with that beef. Add enough water to barely cover and let it cook real slow. And it's very, very simple. It's a real purist's chili. Now, are these greens or reds?
They're greens.
Oh, yeah.
And that reminds me, I wanted to ask you, do you know what variety of chilies? They told me it was similar to Anaheim, but they were kind of mum about exactly what
Well, if it's called a Hatch chili, Hatch, New Mexico is where a lot of research has been done for the chili industry, because chilies, the same plant can have different heat chilies. And Dr. Roy Nakayama was one of the people who years ago tried to develop a chili that's a long chili. They're kind of like Anaheims, but they're going to be hotter and they have more character. And this may be what's called a Big Jim. But it's usually a chili that people will use as is, chopped up. They'll use it, they'll just puree it and then cook it down. And that becomes the green chili that you can put over almost anything, from a taco to burrito, you know, to a tamale, you know, put it into a tamale and you're there. And that chili you can make up. And then you can put it in the freezer and you have it. It's wonderful over eggs, scrambled eggs. It's fabulous. So that's the basic idea. And if you go online checking out recipes from New Mexico, you're going to see even more ideas.
That's what I needed to know. Just get my brain going in the right direction.
Wherever you want velvety heat with a fruity backdrop, this is the chili you'll put in the dish. Whether it be a soup or anything else, and it's fabulous over grilled meat.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Thanks a lot.
Enjoy them, Nan. We've got Selena on the phone from New York City. Selena, what's up? What is on your mind?
Well, hi, Lynn. It's great to talk to you. Yes, we are in New York today. Actually, my boyfriend and I own and operate an 18-wheeler and drive all over the United States.
Oh, wow. That's fabulous.
It's great. We happen to be in the New York area this time. But what I'm calling about, because we really try and get what's local in the different places that we go to, whatever's fresh or local, because
right.
You get to go all over. You get the Rainier cherries in Washington and the lobsters in Maine and the corn from Iowa. And we kind of try and do that whenever we're somewhere, you know, new. But recently we were in North Carolina in the Charlotte area, and I saw black muscadine grapes in the grocery store,
right?
Which I've never seen in the store before, and I don't know if it has something to do with the season they're available, and maybe I just missed it. But the smell reminded me of these grapes that my grandfather used to grow in the arbor in his backyard in the Bronx. And I'm guessing, I don't know, all Italians must have grape arbors in their backyards. But other than just popping them in my mouth and really enjoying that interesting flavor, I'm really not sure what else to do with them.
Well, one of the things, it's going to be hard to do in the 18-wheeler. You're going to need a
kitchen. Well, we actually have a kitchen. We actually have a kitchen in our truck. So
You have a kitchen in the truck?
Yeah, our truck is set up like a small RV. I have a kitchen with a stovetop. I have a fridge and freezer and convection oven, microwave
Selena,
oven.
Do you guys take sort of renters to travel with you? I would be very quiet.
in a heartbeat.
You are talking about my dream to be able to travel the country with a kitchen and just, you know, do exactly what you're doing. But on the muscadine grapes, one of the things that's famous is doing jam or jelly with them. That's one thing. The other thing is they have that distinct. How would you describe the taste?
You know, it's very. I feel like it's very sweet just from the smell to the first bite into the grape. Of course, the skin is so much tougher than what
right.
a regular grape is. So I don't know if that would put people off, but the smell is what really gets me. And I think it's just this sweet I've tasted it in wine before, like a dessert wine.
Right, and that's one of the other things you can do.
And I think it's an unusual taste. I don't know that everybody would love them.
They have a wild taste to me.
Yes.
You know, there's something about them that's really haunting. It's almost woodsy in a funny way, but a delicious way.
I was just going to say musky.
Yeah,
I agree with you.
One of the things that's really wonderful to do with them is if you can crush them up, put them through a food mill, okay, to get rid of this thick skin and the seeds. And then when you're doing anything like pork, rich-tasting fish, you know, it might be salmon, it might be mackerel, that kind of thing. When you're doing beef, even chicken, pan grill, okay, pull those things out of the pan and stir that grape, wonderful, delicious pulp in there with maybe a little bit of vinegar and a tad of brown sugar and a bit of garlic. And then what you do is you take that and you just cook that down, pulling up all those crusty bits from the pan. And if you want to add, you could add wine if you wanted. But the idea is they, because of that unusual flavor, and you want a little tang and snap with a tad of something tart and sour, they make a fabulous pan sauce. And the other thing is, think about making a chutney with them.
Great idea.
Look for recipes for green tomato chutneys, apple chutneys, and substitute the grapes because they're going to love things like allspice and cinnamon and lemon rind and nice fresh ginger, something really kicky. It would be fabulous to do that, do a chutney with it. And then
that's a great idea because then you can put the chutney with anything.
That's right. It can be sweet. It can be, you know, with savory or whatever, and you've got it. And then you could add stuff to it. Like I add sherry vinegar to chutney when I fool around with it. And then another time I'm going to use it, I squeeze a lot of lime juice in it. Or I throw Worcestershire in it because it's going to be right. So you can take that as a base.
All right. That sounds great. That gives me something to start with. I love it. Thank you. And really, if you ever need a cross-country trip, you know who to call.
I'm going to get your number. The day's going to come when I'm going to have that kind of time.
Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you for the call. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Ah, I love it. All right. 800-537-5252. Send us an email, splendidtable.org. Grant's on the line from Omaha. Grant, what do you want to talk about?
Hi. I am an artist and musician turned professional candy maker as of late, and I have a bit of a confection flavoring question for you.
Okay, I hope I can answer it.
I've been working on something seasonal for summer and fall, mm-hmm. you know, and I came up with s'mores. I figured that would be perfect.
Right, yeah.
And they're real simple. They're just a layer of graham cracker, a layer of marshmallow. You kind of adhere those together with a little melted chocolate and then dip the whole thing in dark chocolate with a little drizzle on top, and the chocolate seals in the marshmallow and it doesn't dry out. But and people seem to like them. The problem is I really want to take them to the next level, and I wanted to get that very distinctive campfire smoke flavor in there.
You know what I'm wondering? I realize this is, you really produce a lot of this, don't you?
A fair amount, yeah.
Okay, because what I was thinking is you just take a blowtorch and do a tiny char on top of each marshmallow before you do the enrobing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're going to get that flavor.
Well, I've been kind of, that was one thing I considered. The other thing was to try to build some sort of complicated, like, smoking cabinet that I could actually create some sort of cedar smoke and smoke the marshmallows beforehand.
Yeah, but remember what happens to heat in marshmallows.
Exactly, and that's exactly why that
didn't cabinet
work.
Could be such a holy mess. Picture, you know, goo everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, try the business of just giving it a torch, just a touch. You just need it on the top of the marshmallow. It's going to carry through by the time you get done with the enrobing and the whole thing.
Okay, I'll have to.
Okay. Hey, thanks for the call.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
You know that black and white cow we see in TV ads and in farm pastures? Well, that's the Holstein. She's America's prime cow when it comes to giving lots of milk. But a French veterinarian who got interested in dairy genetics thinks our Holstein needs a leg up, so to speak. Jerome Chateau is president of Normand Genetics, a company that offers dairy farmers Normandy's very own French cow for breeding. Jerome joins us from Paris. Jerome? Thanks for joining us. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
So why don't you like our Holsteins?
Well, you know, I do like your Holsteins, but I also like the farmland and your farmers. And I think over the past decades, things have changed and the dairy economy has reached another stage. And right now there are really two tracks. It's a very intensive mode of production and the less intensive one, and the needs are different for each segment, and the hosting is not necessarily the best adapted to each. And the selection of the hosting has been really, really intense over the past 50 years, thanks to artificial insemination, among other things. And that very nice cow has been made into a very tall, skinny, narrow, and fairly weak animal with very high production, very well adapted to high grain diets and intensive operations, but with lots of problems, even in those operations that are less intensive as well. And that's the problem.
So when you say this, so many words, they've been developed to give us a maximum amount of milk, but you're saying what, do they have problems with their health or the quality of the milk?
Indeed, especially their health, fertility, and longevity. Today, a Holstein barely makes it to 4 years on the average, you know, barely two calves, not even two lactations, you know. So the turnover is very high. There's very little longevity, lots of metabolic diseases, and also very weak fertility. It's very hard to get those Holsteins bred back. And the production, yes, has reached stratospheric levels with very little components, so the milk is not particularly rich. But, but those, all those elements make it fairly unsustainable.
So you have Normandy cows.
That's right.
And you offer those cows for breeding here in the United States. What are the qualities of the Normandy cow?
Well, the Normandy, and unlike the Holstein, has not been selected as intensely on production, milk production only, on quantity only. It's been selected on a variety of traits that include muscularity, so beef production, body condition, and also components, the quality of the milk. And for those reasons, because it's retained its original qualities and a more balanced type of cow that doesn't look as skinny as the Holstein and is more adapted to grass-based systems.
So in other words, this is really a cow for grazing. Holsteins don't graze anymore?
Well, Holsteins have not grazed for about 50 or 60 years. That's a very particularity of the American system, is that dairy cows have basically been kept out of the pasture since the 50s. So Holsteins have been selected since then on no grazing operations, if you want. Of course, you can try to put them back into grazing, but you run into some issues because grass typically is not as consistent as a diet.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know that the Normandy cow in France is famous for the milk and how rich it is, and that milk goes into some very famous cheeses, and then, of course, the creme fraiche. So is this cow being bred here in the United States to increase those qualities in the milk?
Yes, it's definitely one of the reasons why people are interested in this breed. And a number of dairy farmers are paid for components. You know, not everyone is paid for the richness of the milk, but a number are. In this case, they are definitely interested in increasing the richness of the milk. And for those who make cheese, of course, then it's even more of a reason to have Normandy cows.
Jerome, thank you for talking with us.
You're very welcome, Lynn.
Jerome Chateau is the president of Normand Genetics. Now, that Normandy breed, by the way, is known for its sunglasses, that is, dark circles around its eyes, and for the brown and white speckles on its white coat. So keep your eye out. If there's a Normandy cow in the pasture, good cheese could be up the road. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Keep in touch. You have a good one. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Mason Cooley. Moo may represent an idea, but only the cow knows. Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, for more information on anything you heard here today, plus a whole lot more, head to our website, splendidtable.org. Browse our recipes, visit our online store, and get registered for our free podcasts and monthly book giveaway. You'll find all the details at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Noel Clark. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.